back to the bin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. I'm Paul Spataro, and I am here with David Pascarella. What's happening, Dave?
How are you, my friend?
I'm doing okay. I don't know if I want to go beyond that.
I wouldn't go beyond that. And a couple of months go beyond all that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's. I think that is a correct assessment. So, for anybody listening, I think we had a discussion during a show. It could have been beforehand or afterwards, but we were talking about doing the initial introduction of the character Two-Face in the Golden Age. And I'm not sure what banner this falls under for us, because there's the Origins episodes that you do. This could fit under that. This could just be considered a spotlight of Two-Face. We talked about doing a Golden Age spotlight occasionally, so this kind of fits all of them.
Yeah, exactly. So we're not going to pigeonhole it into anything in particular.
No, it's far more expansive than that. But, you know, and before we get into it, the stories, just reading through these, it just emphasizes what we've talked about in the past about how reading Golden Age books is a different exercise from reading Silver Age, which is different from reading Bronze Age, which is different from reading Current. There is a little bit of a different focus for all of them. And I find the most interesting part of this is the monologues that go on while a person's alone. You know, they just have to declare, you know, it's, I guess they, did they have thought bubbles? Because I'm thinking about it. No, they did have thought bubbles, but they'd still have somebody walk in a room and say, oh, it's a good thing that this happened. You know, and they're saying it out loud. And it's like, who are you talking to, dude?
You know, it reminds me of in Blazing Saddles. Where Harvey Korman is, you know, laying out his whole plan. And then he, like, looks at the camera and he says, well, why am I talking to you about this?
It kind of has that. And then, you know, I have to come back to the fact that these books really were written with the expectation that somebody between the ages of 7 and 12 are going to be reading them.
Mm.
And when you think about it from that perspective, and then you take a character like Two-Face or a character like Batman and think about just what legs this character has had and what they've been able to do with it over the years. And it's pretty impressive that something written for somebody who's a prepubescent could have that kind of lasting quality and depth to it eventually. You know, I mean, this isn't, you know, Hop on Pop. Which is a classic, you know, the Dr. Seuss can have some classics, but they don't have the depth and everything of the character. This has got, you know, right from the start, they compare this to Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's just interesting that, you know, it there is a level of literature to these stories, even though they're written for children.
Oh, definitely. Thought went into this. This isn't just something that was thrown out there. That's why it has legs.
And then it goes, you know, you can kind of compare that a little bit to what we've done on some of the Legends issues where you know, my biggest criticism is these are major stories and they're not being treated like they're major stories. They're being treated as like one-off throwaways sometimes. You know, the writers don't seem to grasp the enormity of the events that they're doing.
And I don't quite understand why they don't. And that was particularly with the crime syndicate cases. You know, I don't know why they didn't see it as being the event that it was.
It's going to be interesting to see, you know, when we get there, and I know we're on a tangent off of this, but it's going to be interesting to see as we start getting to stories written by people who grew up with these things, who might see more of a significance to what's going on. Because I remember these books being more eventful. So maybe that's the thing. At this point, they're still being written by, you know, cranky old men who don't think that anybody really cares. So maybe when somebody who read them as a kid and grew up loving them, and that's why they're in the business, is writing them, maybe they're going to have a little bit more depth to them.
I guess, yeah, I could see that being a reason why. Yeah.
And you could see that being a possibility, but until we actually read them and see if they actually have that depth to them, we're not going to know, because, you know, sometimes nostalgia gives us rose-colored glasses, and we think, oh, remember that crossover? That was great. And then you read it, and it's like, oh, my God.
Oh, my God, this was terrible. Yeah. Terrible.
So,
hence the you can't go home again sometimes.
Sometimes, but, you know, but when you can go home again, it's great.
You know, I wonder as far as, like, my books, you know, it's written by Bill Finger. And I wonder if, to some extent in his mind, it was similar to Stan Lee, you know, where he tells the story. Ah, I figured I'd do this for a couple of years and then go write that great American novel.
It's very possible. And unlike Stan Lee, Bill Finger kind of got swept under the carpet for many years.
Yeah, unfortunately.
So I know Scott is... not a fan of that argument, because he thinks what's his name?
Bob Kane.
Bob Kane was, you know, that he should get all the credit, and I can debate that back and forth. I do think it should be shared. I certainly don't want to take credit away from Kane, but Finger certainly deserves his share as well. Anyway. So we're looking at, this is strange too, because it's a story that starts in Detective number 66, and it finishes in Detective 68. Now, I didn't look. Does Detective 67 have a Batman story in it?
Yes, it does. But they tell you at the end of 66, you know,
this isn't going to be... in our October issue. I saw that.
Right.
But what? Which,
you know, you find it odd. Why? You know, it's like, I remember, and the example that sticks out for me the best was the old... Marvel Star Wars comics, where there was a storyline going on and you're waiting for that next issue, and then it comes and it has nothing to do with that, and then it picks up the issue after.
And I think the reason for deadline. That, yeah, I think the reason for that would be that the creative team couldn't meet the deadline, so they had to push it back. And maybe that's what happened here, too. Maybe they saw they weren't going to make the deadline, so they put that little thing at the end that'll be concluded in October, and then they just put a story that they had laying around for issue 67. Maybe that's the reason.
But it still seems odd that they knew that, you know what I mean? That they knew ahead of time.
Yeah, you would think by the time... this went to press, right, they'd say, come on, wrap that up. We got to get to press on that one.
Right. This seems like, yeah, we know. We're just taking a month off. I got a vacation planned. Sorry.
Maybe it was that. Who knows? I mean, we're talking about, what, 1937 here? Who knows what was going on?
But then there's a Batman story in the next issue, so.
But is it by the same creative team?
I would have to look. You ask me too many questions that I don't have appropriate answers. And if only we had some way.
And if you think you have all the answers, I change the questions.
Question.
As if the expression
is 67. Let's see. 67 is... it's written by Bill Finger. So there you go.
But it could be Bill the artist. Fingers,
Bob Kane. Jerry Robinson. It's credited as the same group.
All right, so therefore we will continue to scratch our heads unless they had a Bill Finger, Bob Kane issue laying around that they just hadn't published yet. Who knows what they do? You know, I mean, it's impossible. It's so many years ago, but, you know, the one that came in issue 67 could have been earmarked to be in that month's issue of Batman, and they shifted it over because they weren't ready, but they had a little bit more time to go to press on that one for some reason. You know, who knows?
But what is so funny is all these, up until this point, everything's done in one. There is no, oh, to be continued next month. I mean, in some other books, there's kind of like storylines, but in this, it's one and done. So that they missed the deadline the only time that it's a two-parter.
Oops.
It's almost like maybe they were word of mouth, you know. Once people read this, we're going to get more people in and we're going to let them hang for a month.
For all I know, that is the reason. They wanted to build up some cachet.
But these stories would be so easy to have, you know, one or two on deck to slip in if, you know, there's a problem.
You would think.
It's not like, you know, today where it's everything's got to be in sequence or... But actually today this would be six issues spread out.
Yeah, oh, no question. This would be... This could, you know, this could be 6 to 12 issues. What we get in these two. Now, do you read these entire issues? Because I just read the Batman
used
story.
To, and now I've cut back. I'm reading Batman, and who the hell else is in this? Hold on, I'll tell you in a sec. I read, where the hell is that? I read Batman. I read the Crimson Avenger, and I read Airwave. Since they have tangential connections. But in the beginning, I was reading everything, and I just decided I don't have
time. So you're not reading Jerry the Jitterbug?
No, that got canceled. I'm not reading Boy Commandos, Bart Regan, which was actually... I like that storyline, and Slam Bradley, which is decent.
All right. Well, do you find that are you getting any type of Golden Age fatigue?
Somewhat. That's why I've scaled back.
Frankly,
if the Crimson Avenger, you know, didn't show up in some other stuff later on, and Airwave, I might have dumped them and just be reading Batman.
Yeah, I could see. Reading, you know, Batman, Detective Comics, Superman, All-Star Action Comics. I would read All-Star Comics for the Justice Society. I'd probably read all the big people, you know, Wonder Woman, Flash, and Green Lantern. And that's probably it. I don't know if I'd read the other stuff that's coming out.
Well, I was doing that. I kind of pulled the plug now on everything except Superman and Batman and what happens to be in their books. Because one day maybe I'll go back. But, you know, I started to do like I told you on the other show, like a palate cleanser, reading some other stuff.
Yeah. Oh, I would need that.
You sit down and you read a modern book, you're done in 3 minutes. These old books are so text heavy, it takes you a good hour and a half to read the whole book. If you were going to read it from cover to cover and read everything in there.
And the irony is that those books were made for 7 to 12-year-olds, and the books now are made for middle-aged people.
Yeah. But, you know, think about it. Back then, you got your 10 cents worth out of that book. It took you a long time to read through that book.
Mm. Yeah, especially if you had the reading comprehension of the average prepubescent.
Well, the way the world's going, they might have had a higher reading level than some folks our age.
So, why don't we jump into Detective Comics number 66.
Okey-doke. Not to bury the lead, Detective Comics number 66, cover dated August of 1942.
I said earlier 1937, and I know that it wasn't that, but for some reason the scan says 1937. Do you know why?
Hold on. Gosh.
The title of the scan, that is.
Oh! That's what year they started publishing Detective.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah, that's what it is. Sorry about that.
Yes, that's... See, what did I say about reading comprehension and ability?
Okay, now play with your crayons while I do my synopsis. Cover dated August 1942. On sale June 24th, 1942. A whopping 10 cents. Writer again is Bill Finger. Penciler is Bob Kane. Inker Jerry Robinson. Editor, Whitney Ellsworth. And the title is The Crimes of Two-Face. Our opening shot shows a man in shadow, half in shadow, reading Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. The reader is asked if they have ever tossed a coin to decide something, and then asked to consider a man who has staked his very soul on the toss of a coin. This is a man who has two sides as distinct as day is from night. Meet the most bizarre criminal of all time, the 20th century Jekyll Hyde. Seeing some of the characters in the Batman books, though, I don't know if he's the most bizarre criminal we've seen so far, but whatever. At the Gotham City Courthouse, the young and handsome district attorney, Harvey Kent, that's Kent with a K, known as Apollo Kent due to his good looks, is prosecuting the criminal Boss Maroney for murder. And the first witness is the Batman. After Batman's testimony, Kent pulls out a double-headed coin. The coin belongs to Maroney and was found at the scene of the crime, proving that Maroney is indeed guilty of the crime. Knowing that he's losing the case, Maroney throws a vial of sulfuric acid at Kent's face. Batman tries to pull Maroney's arm away, but the acid reaches the left side of Kent's face. Kent is taken to a doctor and his face is bandaged. A month later, when the bandages are removed, the left side of Harvey's face is revealed to be a hideously scarred mass. Batman, trying to be helpful, knows the only plastic surgeon who could restore Kent's face, Dr. Eckhard. Unfortunately, he is being held prisoner in Germany by the Nazis. Thanks for bringing it up, Batman. Kent's life further declines. He finds people on the streets can't stand the sight of his face. His fiancée, Gilda, is just as horrified. Kent's sanity snaps, and he destroys some of Gilda's art pieces, which depict his unblemished face. Returning home in a fit of rage, he breaks all the mirrors. Harvey then takes Maroney's double-headed coin and mars one side of it, leaving the other side clean. Kent decides by the flip of the double-faced coin that fate will decide his actions from now on. If the clean side comes up, he will wait until the plastic surgeon is free and then resume his normal life. But if the scarred side comes up, he will dedicate his life to crime. The coin lands on the scarred side, and Kent adopts the moniker of Master Criminal Two-Face. Two-Face establishes a hideout as warped as himself, a place divided in half, a new and bright side, and a run-down, distressed side. Using the coin to decide between good and evil, Two-Face commits baffling crimes across the city, and depending on the coin's outcome, sometimes acts as a modern Robin Hood, causing the public's opinion about him to be divided. Two-Face and his newfound gang decide their next move, and after the toss of a coin, they prepare to hijack a two-decker bus and rob the passengers. Their plan is almost successful, but they are spotted by Batman and Robin, who engage the criminals. During the struggle, the driver of the bus is shot, requiring the dynamic duo to focus on stopping the bus before anyone is hurt. Using the handbrake, Robin stops the bus, but Two-Face and his gang escape. Back at the hideout, Two-Face confronts a gang member who has failed him twice. First, he hung mirrors up, despite Two-Face's prohibition. And two, he accidentally killed another member of the gang in the botched robbery. A flip of the coin determines the bungler's fate, and Two-Face kills him. Two-Face then plans their next robbery, a movie theater with two features playing. All Two-Face's schemes involve the number two. While he believes he's too clever, Batman and Robin deduce where Two-Face is going to strike next. At the theater, the audience is thrilled watching Superman on the big screen, when suddenly the image turns to that of Two-Face, and his gang takes control. Two-Face tells the audience this is a holdup, and to surrender their valuables. Robin then bursts in and takes out the henchmen in the projector room, while Batman swings onto the stage, taking out the rest of the thugs. Two-Face confronts Batman, then realizes the police may already be on the way. He flees from the theater, stealing a car. A police officer tries to stop him by shooting out the tires. Two-Face then escapes on foot. When Two-Face reaches his hideout, he finds Batman has followed him. Instead of capturing him, Batman tries to convince Two-Face to leave the life of crime behind and work on the side of the law. Two-Face thinks that the offer is tempting, but he leaves that decision to the coin. He flips the coin, but the coin doesn't land on either side, but instead, it lands standing on its edge, a la Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Batman says Two-Face will have to flip again, but Two-Face can't break his own rules, which only allows for one toss. Now it's up to fate to decide. The answer to the riddle of whether Two-Face will follow the path of good or evil will not be found in the next issue, but the issue after that. And that is my synopsis.
And it's a well-done synopsis.
Oh, thank you too much, sir.
Now, my synopsis is going to be off the cuff because I'm choosing not to read theirs and I didn't actually write one. So mine will not have the panache that yours does.
Panache, you know, it means flamboyance.
Yeah, well, whatever.
I learned that from In the Line of Fire.
Good movie. Anyway. I took some notes. Boy, is his girlfriend shallow, huh? Looks like she doesn't even come to see him in the hospital. She just waits for him to come to her afterwards. I mean, the story is pretty, and it's one of the things I like about this. It's pretty faithful to the way it continued to be developed over the years. There's not, you know, a lot about it that they decided to change or retcon out. You know, this is what it is, other than that he became Harvey Dent instead of Harvey Kent, so as to avoid confusion with Superman. I wonder when that was that they did that. But anyway,
I haven't looked. Are they related? The Kents?
You could have done an Elseworlds story where he was raised by the Kents. this whole thing, like, there's one doctor in the world who could take care of him, but he's in a concentration camp.
Is that not a tease? Come on.
That seems a bit much. And then, you know, the girlfriend is like Alicia in for the Fantastic Four with the sculptures and everything. I liked the effect on page 8 of the scan, where it shows the coin spinning, and then they have the different people giving their opinions of what he is, and they're torn. You know, some think he's a murderer and a criminal, and other people feel he's a philanthropist and he's done right by them because of the flips of the coin. But the coin spinning while this is going on seems to me to be kind of like what you might see in a movie or a TV show. Well, not even a TV show in 1942, whatever. But in a movie in that era, like maybe like a serial or something, I could see seeing the coin flipping, you know, spinning, and then having the voice, or not only hearing the voiceovers, but kind of having the face float in. I could easily see that. So for its time, that's, you know, pretty much of a cinematic effect in the comic. I mean, the art in this era is always a little bit more rudimentary than what it became as it developed. So you always have to kind of take that with a grain of salt, but the storytelling chops are clearly there. The whole bus crash thing, the whole bus crash thing seems to be a little far-fetched. Like, it's like Robin has 2 hours to stop this bus from crashing. So, you know, that just seemed a little off for me. The fact that the guy got killed on the bus, other than Two-Face being annoyed by it, it seemed like they treated it as inconsequential because it was a criminal that did it. As Two-Face started to go away from the theater, the cop immediately pulls out his gun and tries to shoot out his tires, and he doesn't even know it's Two-Face. He just thinks it's somebody going the wrong way on a one-way street. So I think that's kind of amusing.
They took their law seriously back then.
Yeah, and I like the way, you know, Batman tries to talk sense into him rather than just attacking him. Now, when he flips the coin, is his hand also malformed because of the acid?
I was going to bring that up. I don't understand why his hand is malformed, because they're very clear that it only hits the left side of his face. That's it.
Yeah, it's got the green tint, and it looks to be a little mangled. And then this, you know, the coin landing on its end reminded me of the Twilight Zone episode with Dick York, where the coin lands on its side and then all of a sudden he could read minds until it falls over.
Oh, see, I never saw that. For me, I was thinking of Mr. Smith when the governor's got to pick a senator and, you know, one side wants one, the other wants the other, and he flips the coin and it lands like that.
Actually, I said, was it Dick? Yeah, it was Dick York, not Dick Sargent. Sometimes I get the two Darren Stevens confused. Yeah, I have to see Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. I haven't seen that in probably 40 years.
Yeah, it's still a great picture.
Oh, it's Capricorn.
Capricorn 1?
Well, that was the expression they had for Frank Capra's movies, that they were corny, so they called them Capricorn. Anyway. I like this. One of the things I liked about it the most is that it's very true to what we know as the origin of Two-Face 80 years later.
Yeah.
So I think that's really cool that you know, like I said, it had the chops to be the same, you know, to not have to be retconned and changed to make it more more meaningful or realistic. Yeah, it had all of that already.
Does he not look like Frankenstein's monster from his left side?
That's not...
On the last page.
Yeah, that's... You know, he's got like the it almost looks like there's stitching all over his face, and he's got the green and the Frankenstein hair. Yeah, definitely. Although Batman's chin in that last page doesn't look good. A little too jutting. But again, the artwork of that era, again, you know, you have to look at it for the era it came in. So, like, the facial, not even the facial expressions, just the facial features, they're not as detailed as they would become later. You know, the coloring isn't as good. The inking isn't as good. But you see some of the shots here, like I said, it shows that they had the chops to tell the story. The shot of the thug getting shot on the bus, that's a very cool catty corner angle that's on. The shot before that of Robin jumping, you know, the fact that they have it like through a lens, you know, that's very cool. Like some of the angles and everything that are used here, and even some of the panel sizing, I think it's, you know, it's in advance of the time it came out.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. Yeah.
I definitely
agree. Two-Face completely reminds me of a Dick Tracy villain.
Yeah. Was it like a flat-top guy?
Flat-top.
Yeah.
Yeah, flat-top.
Yeah, it's, you know, except he's got the scarring, but otherwise, this definitely a similar character design.
He would have fit in perfect with flat-top, the prune.
Yeah. And then, I like, you know, they were calling him Apollo Kent. Because he was so perfect.
Because he was, yeah. There's almost something along that, you know, pride cometh before the fall. You know, like, oh, he's so good looking. And he knows he's good looking. Look at this.
Well, that's the thing I don't really get here. Is it that his girlfriend is superficial and with him because of his looks? Because clearly she dumps him the second he doesn't have them. Or is he an egomaniac? Is he a narcissist?
I think he's the egomaniac.
So it's both.
Yeah. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if the bust she has of him that he smashes, he gave it to her.
No, I think he says that she's a sculptress.
But I could see him being the genesis behind that. Oh, why, look at this face. This should be memorialized in stone.
Yeah. Well, because he, you know, they try to make him sound like he's perfect, and I even think about, like, when we in the movie The Dark Knight, you know, the character was, you know, until he became scarred and all, he was, you know, a bastion of perfectness. You know, he was, you know, full of total morality and you know, selfless and you know, to the point where, like, Batman was thinking of retiring because they had this guy to watch out for Gotham City. You know, and that seems to be the way he's presented, at least in the trial at the beginning, until the acid goes on his face. But then once the acid goes, I think the story could almost be developed that he rises above his narcissism until he can't lean back on it anymore. And then then you see how important it was to him, even though it hadn't really manifested itself in anything he was doing.
You know, I know it's not in the story, but in my head canon, I almost like to paint Harvey Dent or Harvey Kent as Job that went the other way. He was a guy who had everything. He had good looks. He had brains. He had charisma. I'm even going to throw in, you know, to be an attorney back then, his family had money. Everything. Why would he not be a good guy?
Yeah, and it's easy to be a good guy when everything goes your way.
Right, and then he had that one bad day that we like to quote from the Joker. And this is it. This is how he became what he is.
And, I mean, the whole flipping the coin thing, just that doesn't fit that part of him. So that's just, I guess, the acid made him mentally unbalanced. That's the only way I can kind of... Yeah. You know, acclimate that to it. Yeah. But yeah, you know, I think, yeah, that's exactly right. You know, it's easy to be a good guy when everything goes your way. You have the press fawning over you. You have the beautiful fiance who adores you. You know, the Batman is, you know, looking out for you. You know, everything's going perfectly in your career. So it's, you know, it's real easy to be, you know, benevolent.
Now let's take all that away and let's see what kind of guy you become.
Well, the interesting thing is they didn't even take all that away. All they took away was his looks.
Right. Right, he destroyed everything else on his own.
And, well, the looks and the girlfriend. You know, she left him because of the looks, because she was every bit as shallow, and if not more so, than him. Want to move on to the next one, or do we have anything more on this one?
Yeah, I think I'm good.
You want to rate this, or you want to wait till the end, and we'll rate both?
You want to rate them?
Let's rate them separately.
Yeah. I'm going to give, I mean, the cover, it has, I'm assuming that's supposed to be Two-Face, but it's a very generic cover. You know, it could be Two-Face there shooting at them. It's not a scene from the book. I mean, Batman and Robin look good. Frankly, I'll be honest with you, this scene reminds me of another issue earlier on that involved the clock.
That may be what it's taken from.
But this is definitely not in this book. But it's overall, It's serviceable art, I'll call it. It looks good. The coloring's fine. There's not much. There's a decent background. I mean, it's a generic cover. I would give it a solid B-. The story is an A. And the fact that it's held up pretty much intact from back then till today... You know, it shows you the quality of the story. It's got its roots in the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I think it's a great story. And the interior art, it's a product of the time. It has nice panels, the way it's set up, angles. The drawing is from that time. So, I mean, I think you have to rate it from that perspective. And I would give the art a solid B+. So an overall grade of an A-, I'd give this book.
All right.
The Batman section.
Well, anyway. That's all we're reading is the Batman stuff. Cover is interesting to me. You know, obviously it doesn't have anything to do with what's going on inside. What I find most interesting about it is that Robin looks to be about anywhere from 5 to 10 years older than he is inside the book. You know, he isn't the little kid Robin. He's at a minimum a late teen Robin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he might even be early 20s based upon how he looks. But, you know, it's well drawn, like you say. It doesn't have anything to do with what's going on inside. But and you'd know better than me because you've been doing more of a Golden Age read-through. But I think a lot of the books back then didn't have covers that reflected what was inside of them. You know, they just would have the hero that is in there, but not a specific thing to the story. But I think it's solid. I'm going to say a B for the cover. The interior art, again, as you say, you know, it's a product of its time, and I have to rate it as such. But for the time that this came out, I think it's very solid. I think it shows some advancements in the art form that you don't see in all the books of this day, at least not all the ones that I've read. Again, you're more familiar with it than I am, but I'll take some credit for having read some of them. So for its era, I think this is an AR job. And the story, the fact that it has the legs, you know, it's easy to go with hindsight as opposed to just reading it as what it is. But with hindsight of what it's become and what, you know, how it's held up over the years, I'm going to even give the story an A+. And I'll give the book overall just a flat A.
Excellent.
So then the story is continued 2 months later in October of 1942 in Detective Comics number 68. And the story is titled The Man Who Led a Double Life, written by Bill Finger. The penciling is credited to Bob Kane, inked by Jerry Robinson and George Roussos, lettered by Ira Schnapp, and edited by Whitney Ellison. Ellsworth. And the cover on this one, while it does have Two-Face in it, it really doesn't show what we get within either. It has Two-Face at the top of a silo, kind of standing outside of one of the windows. He looks like he's on one knee with the other leg stepping on the platform of the opening. And he's got two guns, one aimed at Robin, who is to his left, or to the right for the reader, and he's hanging from a some sort of line, maybe an electric line or a phone line or something. And then the other one is aimed downward towards Batman, who's got a thug in his hands, and it says, "Beware Two-Face. Is he one man or two? See, the man who led a double life." And the splash page on this one, which we're already seeing a decrease in the quality of the artwork, shows a bad drawing of Two-Face, I believe, and it's, you know, it's showing he's got Batman, Robin, and a girl in one hand, and he's got thugs who have money bags and are shooting them in the other hand, and there's a bunch of question marks around him, and he looks puzzled. And then above him on either side, there's the coin with one side with a face on it, the other side with a face that's been scratched out. The story opens right where the other one left off, with the coin laying on its side. And as they're waiting for something to happen, a cop bursts in and shoots Two-Face. Story, the end. Goodbye.
Thank you for joining us.
And Batman says, you shouldn't have done that. I might have reformed him. And somehow the cop's got to apologize. But Two-Face apparently was just nicked with the bullet, because with one punch, he takes out the cop and Batman and jumps out of a window. And it turns out the bullet hit the coin that was in his pocket. Now, from what I've seen, at least on TV and in movies, when somebody has a bulletproof vest on, the impact of a bullet into you is usually enough to, at a minimum, really knock you senseless for a while. So this seems like it almost didn't bother him. But, you know, we don't know how much time passed. Anyway, Two-Face goes to a new crime address, and he puts together his gang, and they come up with a plan where they flip a coin to decide if they're going to commit crime during the day or at night. And if it's during the day, they are beneficial to people with whatever funds they steal. And if it's at night, they do it for their own benefit. Now, this whole plot kind of falls flat on me, because there's at one point he pays somebody's mortgage or something. And if Two-Face did that, isn't the person or the people or company that he stole the money from going to turn around and say, hey, wait a minute, that's stolen money. That's our money. You can't pay off this thing. But anyway, moving on. So the next crime they do is on the dark side of things, or the scarred side of the coin, and they kidnap Henry Logan, the Match King. And Batman and Robin are called to Commissioner Gordon's office. And Robin is saying, I bet you were put on the Logan snatch. So they really are just, you know, assistants to the police department at this time. Anyway, they get into Commissioner Gordon's car, and he takes them to a barn-like structure where they go in, and surprisingly enough, they find Logan there. And he's a curmudgeon-y old piece of crap. And it turns out he hated having any type of public persona, so he had a double that he would pay to attend things. So that's who got kidnapped. And he says that Two-Face knew about it, because back when he was the DA, Logan had confided his secret to him. Anyway, he's so broken up that he just wants to kick everybody out of his barn while he continues to make things out of matchsticks. Kind of a weirdo, if you ask me. Anyway.
Oh, big time weirdo.
Anyway, they end up going with the ransom money to Two-Face, and considering the quality of the makeup at the time, it turns out that Batman disguises himself as Logan, while Robin disguises himself as a woman who starts to run up to him, and they say, oh, it's the guy's wife. She was worried about him. And then Two-Face knows that it's not, and they just immediately, like in 2 seconds, they just pull off these disguises and have their Batman and Robin costumes underneath them, which I always find very amusing. Anyway, they take out the criminals, but in the process, Two-Face manages to get away, and it's appropriate that he gets away on a motorcycle, which is a two-wheeled vehicle. So Batman dives on him as he's riding away, and Two-Face actually knocks him out with the coin, which seems very, very weird to me. Then he flips the coin, and it tells him not to kill Batman at that point, and he leaves. So they come back, Batman and Robin come back, and they bring the double to the Logan. While Robin lights a matchstick and gives him a hot foot. And then, moving forward, Two-Face, who escaped, obviously, decides to go back to his girlfriend. And what he does is he puts heavy makeup on so that it looks like he's been fixed. And initially, she shows great excitement about it, and gets a little weird. The flesh looks so clean, I feel like touching it. And he doesn't let her. And then they're sitting and having a candlelight dinner. But unfortunately, the candle's flame causes the makeup on Harvey's face to dissolve or melt away, showing his true look. And she again just rejects him right out of hand immediately. Batman shows up, and Harvey accuses Gilda of pretending, but she says no, and it turns out that Batman figured out that he'd go there, so he's been watching her house. So then, from there, the story just keeps going.
Clearly, this should have been a one-book-ish story.
So from there, because his makeup melted, he's very, very upset with the creator of the makeup, and he burns down his business, which I guess they didn't have insurance back then the way they do now, because he said, that's it, I'm penniless. You know, I don't have anything. And the makeup company owner, his son swears that he's going to get vengeance. From there, Bruce and Dick are trying to figure out how to take out Two-Face, or how to get him caught. And we cut to one of Two-Face's thugs at a notorious criminal haunt, where he meets up with thugs meets up with Getaway George, and becomes fast friends with him. And then the thug introduces Getaway George to Two-Face, so that he can work for him as well, and vouches for him. Next, cutting from there, the next big event is the police fire baseball game. And interestingly, the dynamic duo are playing in the game. Batman is pitching and he's striking people out. And he hits a home run to help them win the game, because they are both honorary policemen. I find it interesting that he's swinging a bat with that cape on. Could you imagine trying to do that? The air resistance and everything?
I could barely swing a bat without a cape on.
Yeah, really, me too. So, but because of the, I guess it's because of the combination of the police and fire, it makes it a double thing. Oh, no, it's a double header. That's what it is. I couldn't remember. Because it's a double header, Two-Face decides that they're going to rob this particular event. And the mayor of Gotham gets up and says that they've raised over $50,000 in paid admissions, which he's holding in a box. And he gets up to a microphone and announces this. And Two-Face then comes over to rob that box from him. But in the meanwhile, Robin takes a hose and takes out some of the thugs. He then takes baseballs and throws them at people. He takes a bat and hits somebody. Meanwhile, where's Batman? Anyway, Two-Face.
And where's all the police that are at the game? And the firemen,
yeah,
for that matter.
All these public servants are gone. So Two-Face has the mayor at gunpoint, and he's ready to shoot him. You know, he's holding him hostage. And just because you know, we were talking earlier and you mentioned Harvey Korman in Blazing Saddles. It makes me think Blazing Saddles, because Robin's like, "Don't, man, he means it." And I just think of Cleavon Little holding the gun to his head. He's just crazy enough to do it. So then they get into the car with, what's his name, Getaway George. And it turns out Getaway George is not Getaway George. He's the son of the mask maker. And he gets Batman there, who takes Two-Face out. And that's it. Although at the end, when he goes to jail, Two-Face says to Batman, "That's only your side of the story. There are always two sides to a story. I'll escape, Batman, and I'll bet you on that, double or nothing." The end. So what this did in my mind is, you said earlier it should have been a one-issue story. It could be longer than the one issue that we had, but it almost feels like it got so convoluted in this issue, and it just so many things that just happened by chance, and just it felt a little silly at points.
It was too convoluted, but too many things.
Yeah, I think that's exactly correct. It's we took the what was essentially a layered simple story in the first one and made it a simple convoluted story in the second one. Like, the motivations and the underlying themes don't feel as complex as the first one, but the plot is just all over the map.
Yes, completely all over.
Now I know why we talked about doing this, why you said, yeah, I'll do the first one, you could do the second.
You know, right after they give the synopsis of what led up to, you know, this point, it plummets downhill.
It's just completely. It just gets too silly. The matchmaker guy, the mask maker's son, the baseball game. There's just too much silliness. This one really does feel like it's written for a prepubescent.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess this one served its purpose more than the other one.
This one is, I'll throw everything up against the wall and see how it lands. And it's funny because the scan on this one, just in case anybody was wondering, I don't own copies of these. The scan is superior. It's a better scan, but the artwork is not as good.
Yeah. No, the artwork is way better.
I don't feel like we're getting really anything that's innovative like we did in the first one.
Just to go through this briefly. Well, you look at the panel where it shows that the coin has stopped the bullet. Now, I am not a soldier, I've never been, or a policeman, or whatever, but I do know that when a bullet is fired from a gun, the whole bullet doesn't come out. It's just the tip of the bullet. That looks like a bullet that you would load in the gun. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, you're talking about...
with the shell casing.
Yeah, you're talking about the casing. That the casing stays in there because that's where the gunpowder is.
Right. So, that's negative number one. The whole, you know, robbing the tennis match and then bringing in the... paying off the mortgage and then jumping ahead to the Henry Logan. Henry Logan is the most unlikable character in the whole book. I would have been great if they had kidnapped him and we never saw him again. And his eccentric behavior with the matchsticks, I don't know. That's got to be a play on something. And I just don't know what it is. But I'll bet you at the time, you know, I have some vague memory of people, whether from television or whatever, of people building things like that out of matchsticks. Do you have any?
Yeah, that does sound like something. I mean, and if you think about it, it does seem like it's something you could have had as a hobby in that time because it wouldn't be crazy expensive. You'd just need the matchsticks and glue.
Right, but this guy's building, you know, like the Eiffel Tower or luxury cruise ship.
Yeah,
he's like the Da Vinci of the matchstick industry.
When they left there and they went to the barn where they were keeping the double, it looks like the silo is made out of matchsticks.
Yeah. looks like the Leaning Tower of Gotham.
It's something that took them forever to stop doing, but I always just cringe when they have, you know, a mask on over the Batman mask.
Well, you know, also the Robin dressing up as a woman is going to become a repeating theme.
Oh, yeah?
I don't even remember. I know it's more than once. I don't know if this is the first time we get it, but it seems like several times already, and I'm only up to the end of the beginning of 43. Robin dresses up as a woman quite often.
I don't know if that's really a good thing to do with, especially with the reputation that eventually...
There's some of these things where you look at this and you go, oh, I could see why they had a problem with this in the 50s. I could see today having a problem with it.
Yeah, well, now, you know, with thoughts of, you know, child welfare and all of that. Especially, you know, Robin at this point is not supposed to be 18, 19 years old. He's supposed to be, you know,
10, right? 11. Something like 10. But when you see them sleeping in the same room, you know, like in twin beds and stuff, it's like, the guy's a millionaire. He's got a mansion. Why are they sharing a room?
Yeah, I mean, I think in that era, that was not looked at as being untoward. I think about, like, you know, like Laurel and Hardy you know, they'd be like roommates and they'd be sleeping in the same bed, but there was nothing that was thought to be sexual about it.
No, but they were two adults.
Yes. But my point is just that at that time, I think they just thought it didn't matter. It's not that it didn't matter. It's that they thought it didn't matter.
Right. Let's see. Moving along here. It's okay if someone's a jerk. It's all right to give them a hot foot.
Well, that is true, isn't it?
Well, I would think so, but try getting away with that. Go to work and try that with the guy that annoys you and see how that goes over.
I'm sure it will be looked upon very favorably.
Now, the Harvey getting his face made up, first of all, that's the most fantastic makeup job possible. I mean, you have no indication his face is all scarred up under there until the candle melts it. Now, I don't even think that's in character with him trying to hide it. But we're still establishing him. It rambles. The baseball game comes out of nowhere. I would love to go to something where the fire department builds a whole building in the middle of a field, sets it on fire to demonstrate how we fight fires. And I don't think this is in Gotham. I think they came to New York because that is clearly Fiorello LaGuardia, who was mayor of New York City back then.
You know, I was trying to figure out, and I was having a tough time with it, so thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah, that's definitely LaGuardia. It rambles and it rambles and it rambles, and it should have just never happened. They could have done a second part and had a more cohesive story that wasn't trying to hit so many beats and just became a mash.
The problem is the disappointment after the quality of the first one. You want the second one to live up to that. And it doesn't.
It's nowhere near the first one. They'd have been better off to end it last issue. But,
I think you could have added two more pages to the story and had it be, you know, something with that coin flip that just didn't work out and that was ultimately the way it ended.
They could have ended it where he has a meltdown because he can't make a decision.
That would have been a good psychological.
I don't know what to do. And Batman just takes him away, and that's the end of the story. And we wouldn't have had to deal with this. So it's a shame because it's a disappointment after the first.
Yeah, I totally agree. So I guess we can, unless you have any other notes on it, we could rate this one.
Now, all I'll say is, at least on the cover of this one, there is a silo, though it looks nothing like this.
Yeah. Doesn't look like a matchstick silo.
No, that would have been great.
So, the cover, I think the cover is probably better drawn than it was on the prior issue. But it has a closer connection to what we get in the story. I'm going to give it a B. I think it's good enough that, you know, if I were in its target audience, I would have wanted to pick it up at the time. The interior art, I think, took a significant drop from the last issue. And I'm going to give the interior art, I'm going to say it's okay. I'm going to give it a C. And the story, I have to kind of balance my disappointment with it not carrying up the level of the other one with just, you know, how do I rate it on its own? And I think I'm going to say a C minus.
Mm-hmm.
So, overall, I'm going to give the book, I'm going to give it a C. I'm going to say it's okay, but not better than that.
Yeah. There's something about the cover on this one, the way the silo is drawn, that I feel they're fighting on the set of like a Renaissance fair. You know, but it's serviceable. I'm not going to beat this to death. I'm with you. I give the cover a B. The interior odd. Ugh. It's a big step down. I would go with a C on the interior as well. The story. You know, I'm battling within myself because I don't know whether it's that bad considering the time it was written in. Or is it I'm just so disappointed because the first half of the story was so good. But just the complete random rambling of the story. For some reason, I could almost hear like the Flintstones music playing in the background. You know when Fred used to drive the car, you heard that. Dun, 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 dun. That's what's running through my head. So the story, I am going to give a C minus. With an overall grade of a C on this book.
Yes, I think we landed in the same place. But it was still fun. You know, it was fun for me to dip my toe into the Golden Age and look at this. I don't know if I would enjoy it more if I were doing the regular Golden Age book or if I would enjoy it less. I'm not sure. But I like the idea of occasionally going back to the Golden Age and looking at a story. Especially ones, you know, I mean, you and Scott are doing the origin shows, so that's going to take a lot of the key introduction of characters, but characters like this that don't quite merit an origins issue but are worth taking a look at the first appearance, I'm definitely up for that.
Well, you know, it's fun visiting the Golden Age when you have like the known characters. Do you know what I mean? You have the Joker, you have the Penguin, the Catwoman, Two-Face. But it's like you have to remember the majority of these stories are Joe Thug.
Yeah.
And it's that way in the Superman comics, too. You'll go through periods where, you know, there is nothing but Superman fighting, you know, insurance fraud. I remember Michael Bailey saying on a podcast once, you know, it's like amazing how much insurance fraud there is in the 30s and the 40s.
Well, there was also, you know, I did like the very indignant Superman, like I guess it was in the first issue when he, like, there's the guy who's beating his wife and, you know, like, I like that. But, you wanted to see him fight a super menace, especially as they started to amp up his powers.
Well, it coincides, I think, around the beginning of the war where all these characters go from being, you know, on the edge of society to now they're all, you know, agents of the government.
Right.
You know, where you hit specific, like Batman and Robin, they're specifically deputized and all that. But up until that point, you know, they're vigilantes. So is Superman. And then as the war rolls around, oh, no, you know, everybody's an agent of the government.
Interesting stuff. So I guess I'm going to call it on that for this episode. Thank you, everybody, who's been listening. This was fun for us. I hope it was fun for you. If it is, as we have asked in the past, if you want to go into whatever service you use to get our show and give us 5 stars, we would love that. And we would appreciate it very much. But thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiManzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.